From the campus of Yale University, this is Business Talk with Jim Campbell, nationally syndicated across the country on the Biz Talk Radio Network and coming to you from our flagship stations, Yale Radio WYBC and 1490 AM WGCH Greenwich. All talk and all business, 60 minutes of radio with leading figures from the world of business along with the business of politics and sports. Fate, friendship, and shattered dreams of a chosen few, how life changes in an instant. Four friends from an elite prep school, including JFK Jr., whose dreams were cut short in springtime of their lives. A fellow classmate tells her story, and we'll weave in some of the latest on Jeffrey Epstein scandal from our guest, also leading investigative journalist on Wall Street. That's all on Business Talk with Jim Campbell. William D. Cohen is the best-selling author of The Last Tycoons, about Lazard Investment Banking House. It won the 2007 Financial Times Goldman Sachs Business Book of the Year Award. And then he's the author of House of Cards, a great book about the fall of Bear Stearns, Money and Power, about the dominance of Goldman, Price of Silence, the Duke Lacrosse Scandal, and Why Wall Street Matters. Correspondent at Vanity Fair, writes for the New York Times, an old friend of the show, the book, Four Friends, Promising Lives Cut Short. Welcome back, Bill.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. You're calling in from on assignment in a tough location, I understand.
Undisclosed location, yes.
Before we jump into Four Friends, I know we talked offline, and I think you had an article in Vanity Fair, Hive, their online thing, on we're trying to figure out where Jeffrey Epstein made this $560 million he reports he has. There's this Leslie Wexner, that he only dealt with billion-dollar guys, that he was a tax advisor. Do you have a sense now where you think his money came from?
I mean, I have a sense, Jim, but I don't think it had anything to do with, you know, managing money or tax strategies or structuring advice or derivatives. I think all of that. I mean, again, we have to really stipulate that we're kind of in the land of speculation here. I've never met the man. I've never talked to him. He's obviously not talking to anybody now. We probably won't know the truth until and unless prosecutors in the Southern District issue subpoenas for the people who do know, and then they come in and talk about it, and somehow that information becomes public. But my reporting on all of this suggests to me that it had more to do with services, shall we say, that he provided people who wanted discrete services and couldn't get them in other places. And this included not just, you know, the Leslie Wexners and Leon Blacks of the world and Glenn Dubins, but also I think it included, he always seemed to have a smattering of sheiks and emirs and intellectuals at his mansion. So I think if you sort of step back and say, you know, there are things that people like that want, and you need discretion to get. I think that frankly, what Jeffrey Epstein was providing, because you don't get to be a half billionaire providing tax advice. I'm sorry, yeah. You just do not.
Can you make that kind of money providing that services? Let me ask you this: the thing that I read about this Stephen Hoffenberg, who ran that collection agency that became a $450 million Ponzi scheme, he had Epstein as a consultant. They floated like $300-400 million of notes, which they used basically to support the Ponzi. Isn't there a chance that he could have taken a couple hundred million of that as seed money for that's now $600 million?
Again, I don't know. That seems, I mean, other than the fact that he was somehow involved, that doesn't seem to be where the reporting is leading people. It seems that he had leverage over people, and he was willing to use it, and he would use that leverage to trade. I mean, if you look at his unaudited, you know, so-called financial statement, it's very real estate heavy. So he had the mansion in Manhattan, which is, you know, massive, yeah. That was once owned by Les Wexner. I mean, why would Les Wexner give it to Jeffrey Epstein, or even for a nominal amount, unless there was leverage involved? He had the place in New Mexico, which was huge. He had the island in the Caribbean, which was huge. He had the place in Paris. you know, so I don't get the sense that, I mean, he was a college dropout. He taught math at
Dalton.
At Dalton for a few years and then lost that job, somehow finagled that into a job at Bear Stearns because of a tutoring assignment with somebody who was related to Ace Greenberg or New Ace Greenberg. I mean, you know, that's how Jimmy Cain got to Bear Stearns, because he played bridge and Ace wanted to know how to become a better bridge player, but he didn't last long at Bear Stearns. In fact, I hear, you know, he got fired from what I'm told. And so, you know, he claimed to be trading derivatives even before the derivatives market was even formed. So to me, it's all a big cover story that we just don't know the truth.
God,
about
he must
that.
Be a total scumbag. Now, these folks like that you were talking about getting these discreet service, whether it's Prince Andrew or Dershowitz or Clinton and all these guys that have been Trump who were named in it. Do you see any of these names ever coming out?
Well, these names are, you know, in this. I wrote a piece in Vanity Fair about his black book, and these names are in this black book. Now, what the purpose of this black book was is, you know, anybody's guess, but whether it was people he wanted to know, I think it was more than people he wanted to know. I think it was people he did know. He would have lots of numbers for these people and lots of ways of getting in touch with him. So I think these were the people that he, quote-unquote, provided services to, and whatever those services were, they were not financial advisory services, because, you know, I did that work for 20 years on Wall Street, and I would have come across a Jeffrey Epstein if he had any ability whatsoever as a financial advisor of any sort.
So these guys, somebody's sweating in it that's in that black book, right?
I think a lot of people are sweating in that black book. I mean, I think their only hope is that, of course, he hasn't been charged with financial crimes.
Right.
So there's really no reason, although maybe he should be, so there's probably no reason for, you know, the Leon Blacks and the Leslie Wexners to be subpoenaed for that. I mean, you know, if the human trafficking allegations, I don't know how they figure into that, if at all. So it might be that Jeffrey Epstein never sees the light of day again, and we just do never find out how he made this money. But I assure you, if there is, in fact, $500 million or whatever it is, it's all going to be confiscated by the government, I would assume, at some point.
I'm cynical. I don't think it'll ever come out, all these guys that are probably... Now, let's go to Four Friends. This book, to me, totally out of the norm from what you've ever done, and of course, it shakes you to read it. Tell us why you did it.
Well, first of all, Jim, I don't really love the idea of being pigeonholed as a...
Right.
Financial writer. I mean, I my interests are broader than that and more complex than that. And, you know, just like I wrote the book about the Duke Lacrosse case, which was about the judicial system, this was a book about four friends of mine, obviously, from Andover, who died young and tragically well before their time. It was about a period of time where you had intense friendships. Then, you know, you all kind of went your separate ways, and there was no social media, there was no cellular telephones, there was no easy way to keep in touch. If you didn't have somebody's a dorm payphone number, then, you know, you didn't really keep in touch with them. And, you know, most guys don't write guys letters, so you sort of lose touch. And then, you know, when you're, you know, 30s and 40s, you hear about these deaths, and, you know, I was trying to make sense of it all, just like I was trying to make sense of the Duke Lacrosse case. I was trying to make sense of what happened at Bear Stearns. I was trying to make sense of how Goldman Sachs survived the financial crisis. So basically, it was a mystery that I was trying to solve, and it was a great intellectual and reporting challenge, because obviously they weren't here to interview and talk to. And aside from JFK Jr., of course, the rest of them were hardly household names. So to me, it was a way to honor their memories, explore ideas of the fragility of life, and also have a tough reporting challenge where I had to triangulate around what happened to them in their lives by interviewing the people that they came across after I no longer was part of their lives.
Yeah, you certainly it was a brilliant investigative job. We only have a minute left in this segment, so obviously beyond the randomness of dying young is Andover. That's the link between all you guys. Can you start to go through the culture of Andover and the feeling of the folks that are there?
Well, you know, Andover, like every all sorts of places, changes from generation to generation. But when I was there, it was just coming out of a period of time of great rigidity. It was sort of run by an ex-Marine who, even though the 60s were happening, pretended as though they didn't happen. So there were strict rules. And then along came a guy named Ted Sizer, who had been head of the Harvard School of Education. And basically the place just sort of loosened its collar and breathed and, you know, sort of unleashed all this creativity. And it just merged with the women's school down the road, Abbott Academy, and became fully coeducational. So it was really an incredibly creative and interesting place when I was there.
We'll be back with more Four Friends. Back with Bill Cohn. He's written about the untimely deaths of four Andover classmates of his. It was class of 77 at Andover. Give people a sense of, I mean, these are the top folks in the country. They're elite. They're often from big, you know, wealthy, famous, old WASP families, if you will. So there's this, is there a sense of invincibility and entitlement, and the dreams can be reality that, you know, most folks could only literally dream about?
To your point about sort of only elites and privileged, I mean, the whole setting is incredibly privileged, and I mean, Andover's endowment is now well over $1 billion, more than a lot of colleges and universities. But when I was there, it was felt very ecumenical to me, and you know, sort of like there were no judgments. One of the important rules of the way Andover conducted itself was to try to attract youth from every quarter. So what that meant was that yes, there were a large slug of elite and privileged people, but there were also, and you know, people like John Kennedy Jr. Mm-hmm. But there were also lots of people from all sorts of different backgrounds, and Andover made a special point of trying to attract those people and making sure that if they couldn't afford it, that they got to go anyway. And so I found it to be, as I say, incredibly ecumenical, a melting pot of different people, and unbelievably encouraging of creativity and quirkiness. And, you know, there's nothing you could do, you know, as long as you didn't violate too many rules that wasn't sort of encouraged and celebrated. I mean, you know, crazy behavior was encouraged. And, you know, as I say in the book, you know, one got the sense that you were part of some sort of Delta Force, a special group of people that literally you could do anything that you put your mind to. Now, you know, that's sort of a myth, and of course that's not reality, because mm-hmm. you know, when you get out of a place like Andover and you hit the real world, you discover that just because you want to do something doesn't make it possible to do it. So but you were in this sort of cocoon of great sort of intellectual fervency, and you know, quirkiness was rewarded, you know, athletics were rewarded, and sort of intellectual debate and openness was all rewarded. And so you really felt that you could, as I said, you could almost do anything you put your mind to. And obviously, as I think I start the book by talking about how there was only one high school in the United States that has produced two presidents of the United States, and that is Andover. It happened to be Bush 1 and Bush 2. You know, you did get a sense that you could do anything if you put your mind to it.
The and coupled with that was pressure, was a sense of real pressure of expectations. Was that there? I know when we talk about three out of the four folks that died, if they'd exercised a little bit more prudence, right, they might have lived. Walking away with just pressure of expectations all the time?
Well, I mean, there were high expectations academically, for sure, but there was a lot of wiggle room as well. As you know, in the story of John Kennedy, obviously, yeah. He had to repeat a year. He was a special case, probably, but you know, Harry Bull ran into academic troubles, even though he was brilliant, and then left for a period of time and then came back. So expectations were high. There were people who were really quite brilliant, and so then people like me were wondering, oh, my God, who are these people? I've never seen any kind of this kind of thing before in my life. But, you know, there are ways to sort of shine despite in other ways, despite the academics, you know, whether it's on the athletic field or in extracurricular activities. I was business manager of the independent newspaper. You know, we made more money running that thing than had ever been made before. And so, I mean, that gives you sort of freedom and makes you feel like you're part of the community and accomplishing things. And again, it's all sort of a bit of living in a bit of a bubble, because then you get into the real world, and you realize that, you know, the kind of nurturing and encouragement that you got at Andover is not what you get even remotely in a college or university setting, let alone in the real world.
Obviously, I assume you've had others die in your class. Was there some magic to these four you picked out, or just that you knew them more, or what?
I did know them, and I think they were sort of part of the first wave of classmates to die tragically and unexpectedly, and not from health-related issues. I think that was, I wanted to use them to, you know, I'm almost 60 now, and you know, you get to a certain point in your life, and you realize that you're not going to go on forever, and sort of the fragility of life, and sort of, you know, as the existentialists tried to teach us, you sort of try to live each day as if it might be your last, which of course is a nice thing to think about, but is obviously very difficult to do. But you know, you think you're going out on a sail with your two daughters, yeah, and or you think you're going to take a deposition for a client, or you think you're, you know, coming home from a party in Brooklyn, or you're going up to, you know, to a wedding in Hyannis, and you know, next thing you know, that's not what's on the agenda anymore.
Jack Berman, from a chicken farm in Connecticut, the Jewish kid, son of Holocaust survivors. And tell us a little bit about a story. And I thought it was interesting, too, that at that time, Andover was 5% Jewish only. And you were there and thrived, right? Never felt any discrimination or anything.
No, I didn't. But, you know, in the researching of this book, I came across, you know, these quotas that Andover had for this Jewish population in the 40s, and letters from headmaster Claude Feiss, who, you know, writing another headmaster in London, talking about how, you know, it has to keep the population of Jewish students down because they're going to overrun the place if we didn't keep a quota. And so, you know, that was a bit shocking to me. And some of my good friends in Andover who were Jewish, their fathers had gone. And so I'd heard stories from them about, you know, the quotas and how there were 1,200 students in Andover when I was there, and maybe, you know, 60 or 100 at most Jewish students, more like 60. I mean, so it was there was not a quota when I was there, but you know, there certainly were not a lot of Jewish kids there. And you know, again, I didn't feel like I was any different than anybody else. It was, as I say, an incredibly ecumenical and supportive place. But that's what made sort of Jack. I wanted to be able to, you know, tell Jack's story and also be able to tell the story of what it was like to be a Jewish kid at Andover. And you know, Jack's story is so incredible about how his parents met, you know, in a refugee camp after World War II, after having been in concentration camps. And then they had a child in the refugee camp who was 10 years older than Jack, his brother, and basically was raised by the older brother because when they moved to this egg farm in Connecticut, the parents only spoke Yiddish, and Jack's brother spoke English and Yiddish, and Jack, of course, didn't want him, you know, they wanted him to be a rabbi, but the brother realized that he was too smart to be a rabbi in rural Connecticut, and somehow they brought him up to Andover, and he was admitted, even though the regular admissions process was over. He was also given a half scholarship. I mean, his story to me is incredible, and I didn't know any of that, you know, so all I knew was that he was like Jack Berman, the guy who was like a year or so ahead of me in Andover, who, you know, I would see Friday night when we would go to services together.
Be back, more Lives Cut Short. Back with Bill Cohen, Four Friends Promising Lives Cut Short. Before we move on, Jack Berman was like the one guy who didn't
die in your book of sort of some sort of recklessness, sir. I mean, this is terrific how he died, right?
I mean, it's horrific. You know, he was a lawyer in San Francisco. He was working with a client, a woman who believed that she was improperly fired from EDS, Ross Perot's company, and so Jack was representing her in a lawsuit against EDS, and they were together for her deposition at another law firm, not Jack's law firm, at EDS's law firm at 101 California Street in downtown San Francisco, and they were there taking the deposition, and while they were there, this, you know, sort of deranged ex-client of the law firm, you know, sort of waltzed in with a bag full of automatic weapons and just started, got up to the floor where the law firm was and just started firing away on all sorts of different floors, killing, you know, around a dozen people that day, two of whom were Jack and his client, Jody Sposato. And, you know, and obviously, that is incredibly tragic. It's what led to the assault weapon ban that was passed by President Clinton in 1994, which had a 10-year sunset, which is why it sunsetted in 2004, and we don't have it anymore, which is, of course, one of the great tragedies of American society. But, you know, can you imagine going to Jack's widow, who I'd never met, and having her tell me this story of her husband and that day and what was going on and what she was thinking? Yeah. I mean, it was incredible to that she agreed to do that, and that I could sit there and listen to that story and tell that story of what happened.
How's his son doing today?
I think you know, he's fine. He didn't really know. I mean, I've spoken to him. He didn't really know his father. He was only about one when his father died, but he knows what happened, and I think he was thinking about being a lawyer for a period of time. He was a bike racer for a period of time. I think he's a good kid.
Good kid.
His mother has raised him right.
Now this guy, I think you did room with at least for a year, and his whole weight of expectations deal. He was Harry Truman's grandson and the son of the New York Times managing editor, right? Will Daniel.
Right. He was Harry Truman's grandson. Clifton Daniel was the managing editor of the New York Times for a number of years after being a highly respected foreign correspondent in the New York Times. They lived on Park Avenue in a triplex apartment. He was one of four brothers, and the parents were quite distant and older. And Will was a brilliant guy, always, though, trying to run away from his legacy. So you know how some kids embrace the legacy and try to take advantage of their legacy. Obviously, John Kennedy Jr., there was no getting away from his legacy.
Yeah.
But Will Daniel, his name wasn't Truman, so he could hide, and he chose to hide. And so he went through his whole life acting as though he was just a regular guy and trying to make a difference in the world. He really, you know, he could have been a banker, he could have been a journalist, he could have been a politician, but he ran as far away from all that as he could, and he worked with homeless men. He worked with homeless men trying to get them to vote, and he worked with them to try to reduce the incidence of AIDS in their population. He was an incredibly sort of selfless, directionless and sort of somewhat aimless guy. And one of his friends from Yale, who had kept a letter that Will wrote to him, and Will was one of the few guys who did write letters, and shared it with me, to show you sort of how complex Will was. He used to talk about how when he would start dating a new woman, he would be eager to break up with her, even before the first date, to sort of get that out of the way. Because he knew that, you know, his personality was such that when it got close to having to commit to something, he was going to run into trouble.
And again, this guy also died, sadly. He was drunk and, I guess, hit by a cab.
Right. He was walking back to his mother's apartment on Park Avenue. He didn't live there. He was 41. He lived in a rental apartment in Englewood, New Jersey, across the river from Manhattan. But, you know, if you're out partying in Brooklyn till 2 o'clock in the morning, there's no way to get back to Englewood, New Jersey. So he decided to stay at his mother's apartment, which he called the Old Homestead. And he was crossing Park Avenue and got hit by a cab. You know, I don't know whether that was an accident or some people think it might have been intentional on his part. I don't know.
Hmm.
We'll never know. But, you know, talk about a crazy way to go.
Very sad. Now, JFK Jr., it's a fascinating chapter in the book. And you get a sense that he kind of saw himself as immune to the rules at Andover and just pushed that and had almost this death wish of need for physical risk, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, it's important to remember that he's the only child born of a president-elect. He was born, in November 1960 after the November election and literally, you know, grew up in the White House. You know, until his father was assassinated tragically when he was 3 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the normal rules of life did not apply to John. Not only was he, you know, probably the most handsome man that has been, you know, around in a long time. So that, for one reason, you know, women just threw themselves at him. So that's number one reason why the normal rules don't apply. Number two is, you know, he had Secret Service till he was 16, who would basically do anything he wanted. That was another reason that the rules didn't apply. And number three is he was John F. Kennedy Jr. And so, you know, literally people would do whatever they could do to be in his presence. And, you know, because it was fun and it was exciting and he did all the best things and he had access to all the most fun parties and the most interesting people and the most adventurous things. And, here's a guy who really was constantly borrowing money, would lose his wallet, would lose his pants. I mean, you know, he was a great guy and a very normal guy, very well adjusted for somebody like him, but he didn't think, you know, the rules of normal rules of the road applied to him in large part because they didn't. And so, you know, and then I think part of is you talk about this need for putting his body in physical danger. He did that on a constant basis. I mean, I uncovered examples of that I had no idea about. And I knew him pretty well. And, you know, when you put it all together, you know, you sort of, why are you taking these crazy physical risks, especially when you've seen your cousins and nephews take the same physical risks and, you know, cost them their lives.
You know, the book, to me, there are revelations here. The degree to which his marriage was in trouble and she was unstable, manipulative, had cheating on him, cut off sex. And then at the same time, the magazine is unraveling.
I know. It was an incredible confluence of events and, you know, the marriage unraveling and you know, she wasn't going to go to the wedding in Hyannisport and basically her sister, you know, trying to keep them together or at least through this wedding, because if they didn't go to the wedding together, then of course everybody would know what was up. And so the sister convinces them to, you know, to keep it together, even though he was living at the Stanhope Hotel and she was living down in their apartment down on North Moore Street. And so they go up, you know, in the plane. He usually flies with a flight instructor. He was not rated for instruments. He wasn't experienced for instruments, but he, you know, because his wife was, you know, like an hour plus late, because she was indulging herself, you know, getting made up for the weddings and everything, that he told the flight instructor to go home and be with his family, which is, you know, a very nice thing to do, but also a huge risk that he took, a needlessly huge risk that he took because, he wasn't rated and it was a very dense, humid, foggy August night. And,
that's
just a tremendous error in judgment, obviously.
I'm a friend of one of his cousins, and who actually flies, and he told me that JFK had no real feel for flying. And, you know, spatial disorientation is really a feel thing.
Oh, I mean, and you know, knowing what to do, counter your,
yes,
your instincts when you get into that situation, and he obviously didn't know what to do. And but, I mean, he had, you know, he also had one of these crazy whirlybird kind of contraptions that he, you know, broke his foot in over Memorial Day weekend up in Martha's Vineyard that same year. I mean, you know, who does that?
And I didn't know that either. We got our final segment coming up. What's it all mean? Final segment, Wall Street investigative journalist, author Bill Cohen. So I know you thought this book was hard to write. What do you come up with? The randomness of life? There's some invincibility coming out of Andover that encourages some recklessness. How did you resolve these early deaths?
Well, I think what was driven home to me was just about the fragility of life.
Yeah.
You know, obviously we all know we're going to die. I mean, nobody gets out alive. But, you know, I just think that I wanted to pay homage to my friends. I wanted to figure out what had happened to them in their lives and what led them to these tragic moments, whether, you know, it was their fault or not. I wanted to sort of recall a time at this very special high school, you know, before there was cell phones and social media and easy ways to keep in touch. And to me, it was a great experience. I don't think it, you know, this idea that somehow we felt that we came out of there and, you know, the rules of nature didn't apply to us. No, I mean, I think it was a sense that, as I said before, you know, if you, you know, you could do what you put your mind to, or that was what they made you believe. And so, unfortunately, that could lead to a number of disappointments in life when you realize that that's not going to happen. But I don't think it didn't instill in you this sense that, you know, the rules of nature and gravity don't apply to you. I mean, no. I mean, you know, it wasn't as though we got out of there thinking you're going to live forever. But you did get out of there thinking that, you know, you've been given a special education and you should do something with it. You have an obligation to use it wisely and to achieve something great.
Your own, on a personal sense, do you come away with something as obvious as live each day to the fullest, or is there some other takeaway or message that you intended?
Well, I mean, so when I was at Andover, we did study the French existentialists. I did, and you know, their whole message is, you know, live each day as if it were your last. And you know, the more I thought about that, I mean, obviously that's virtually impossible thing to do, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
you
have to pay the mortgage and you have to, you know, go to work each day. I mean, those are not things you would do if you knew it was going to be your last day. So
yeah.
I was trying I thought that writing this book would give me a way to explore those ideas, to explore the idea of knowing, you know, we're the only creature that knows about its own death, right? We know we have knowledge that we are going to die, and yet we don't live our lives as if every day were going to be the last. Because if every day was going to be the last, you'd probably just sit around eating macaroni and cheese all day long. and yet, here are four of my friends who thought that they were in the prime of their lives, and yet they went out one day and something happened, and that was the end of it. And I don't know. It just seemed like something I needed to do. And wanted to do. I wanted to remember them and remember the school and my experience at the school, and also have a keen reporting challenge. And I think I was able to achieve all of those things. And the response that I've gotten from people has been extraordinary. I mean, maybe it's because most people don't really care that much about Goldman Sachs or Bear Stearns or Lazard, and, you know, and they don't sit there. But, I mean, these are very personal stories that I think everybody can relate to, and the reaction from people has been every day, literally, Jim, every day I've gotten emails from people who I don't even know telling me how much this book has meant to them.
Interesting. Let me. Was there any sense, three of these four deaths really didn't have to happen, And I'm wondering, is there something in there about risk-taking or being more careful about risk-taking? And we had the same thing on Wall Street on a, you know, on a conceptual basis, right? After 08, risk-taking became a big, you know, issue from, again, almost reckless deaths of institutions.
Yeah, I think in the case of three out of the four, in the case of Will Daniel, Harry Bull, and John, I thought about this a lot. I really think they kind of died like they lived.
Yeah.
In other words, they took too many risks. You know, they took risks that you wouldn't, you know, you mean, for instance, with Harry Bull going out sailing on Lake Michigan and letting his kids swim off the boat without life preservers and knowing you can't anchor the boat. I mean, that was something that they'd done before.
Yeah.
It wasn't just like a one-time thing. They had done that before. So why would you do that?
And he was very careful guy. Normally, right?
And he was a very careful guy. He was a lawyer and
interesting.
And you know, meticulous and brilliant. So I mean, John of course took lots of risks, and Will of course was a bundle of contradictions and struggling. And so I mean, you know, of course he drank too much, and I guess that you know, as I say, he kind of died like he lived, and Jack was just literally in the wrong place at the wrong time. I mean, talk about somebody who was, you know, should be sainted. I mean, he was trying to defend somebody who thought they were wrongly dismissed work.
I enjoyed the Harry Bull thing, too, because I grew up in the Midwest. I grew up in Lake Forest, where that boat was one of the areas they look for the boat when they were missing. And you can I just know the kind of person he must have been. And very loyal to his father and all that, and went into the family. Interesting, too, the day he made partner, right, he quit.
Yeah.
Who does that?
Well, I guess his father was waiting for him to make partner and prove that he could do that at a big, you know, Wall Street law firm, Winston & Strawn. And then he wanted him to come back and run the family business, which was a, you know, fairly successful paper business in the Midwest. You know, and he had really gotten his act. He had a loving wife and a beautiful family, and I mean, he was such a great guy. He had so much charisma and energy and personality, and he was really one of them. I mean, I you know, I'm a liberal Jewish guy from Massachusetts, right? I can't help myself. He was like the first sort of intellectual conservative I'd ever met in my life, and you know, did it in the nicest way. I mean, you know. He could disagree without being disagreeable, and I thought that was so nice and charming, and he was so brilliant, and just so senseless.
The book does kind of shake you up. It's very personal, and as you say, three of the four are not even known guys, so it really hits you. The Harvard, Yale, Princeton, in your era, 50% of Andover got in there. Is it anywhere like that now?
No. It's nothing like that anymore. That was really quite something.
Oh,
I mean,
my
it used
God.
To be
I was
more.
Yeah. How
is as I said in you know, the book, and I, you know, I went to Duke and was made to feel like a loser.
Yeah, I know. Duke is impossible to get into. What are you doing next?
GE. Book about the rise and fall of GE.
Oh my God! I just did an interview with the guy at J.P. Morgan, who's the number one contrarian analyst on them, and a fascinating company, and they're in big trouble. Thanks to Bill Cohen, and I look forward to that book, by the way, big time. Thanks to Bill Cohen, his book Four Friends: Promising Lives Cut Short. Always does great work. It's been Business Talk with Jim Campbell. Thanks to Bill. Thanks to our national audience. Everybody, on the next edition of the show.